Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake, another one of our Saturday shows, which means we are both imbibing.
Beer again. Yeah, slightly different. Well, I'm having the same beer you did because I haven't seen them all.
The Bell's American Brown Ale. Yeah. And I'm having Fuller's, which is a London brewery. I'm having their porter, which I've never had before. And I do, when I go back to London, I do like to, if a pub is a Fuller's pub, I'm like, oh, I'll go in there. Because unlike here in America, and I'm sure we've had this discussion before, pubs in England, some pubs are free houses, which means they sell a wide range of draft products. Right. But some pubs are actually sort of, I don't know if they're technically underwritten, but they're affiliated with a specific brewery.
I imagine they must just like sign a contract. Like to get these types of beers, you agree to do this and they'll give you whatever. It's not like a franchise. It's not like McDonald's or something like that, but it's basically signing up a deal to only.
So I think here in America, if you're like, oh, I like Bud. Oh, well, right. my local bar is a Budweiser pub, then I know I'm getting Budweiser on draft. And so, like I say, Fuller's...
Don't they have some pubs that are owned by the breweries?
Some pubs are owned by the breweries, and then I think the next level is your pub has, as you've just said, a deal with the brewery. And like I say, because I like Fuller's products, they have a nice English bitter called London Pride. When I'm back in London... A Fuller's pub is I'll go into the Fuller's pub.
Yeah, no, and
but
I
it's
like
not my
Fuller's
favorite.
Too.
My favorite is actually a brewery in South London called Young's.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you've accompanied me to London, we've been into a Young's pub, and I like
that. Why don't they bring that? Do they bring any Young's over here?
You can
quite a few Fuller's products.
You can sometimes find in like your local wine megastore, you can sometimes find Young's Ramrod. Mm-hmm. Which is a slightly stronger when I say for Britain is like 5 or 6%. If you go into a pub in England and just have a pint of bitter, you're looking at something that's 3-3.5%.
Right.
So I have been into pubs where I've seen different like Young's, something called Ramrod and like a
named chocolate. After Bruce Springsteen song.
No, I don't know that. No, I doubt it. I don't know what kind of following Bruce Springsteen has in South London. Probably more than South Philly. I don't know.
We know of one major fan of Bruce Springsteen in the London area.
Yes, my mum, bless her, loves Bruce Springsteen. I don't think she's as big a fan of either Young's
or Ramrod.
Or Ramrod, yes. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I'm drinking.
Okay.
So it's one of our Saturday shows. We have a couple of different things on the docket.
Yep.
But we'll start off with some catch-up old stuff. Oh, before I say that, can I tell you, I was watching CNN this week, and they were discussing Bill O'Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the fact that he's off telly because of his indiscretions.
They're basically like laughing and they're like high-fiving each other and stuff on CNN.
Anyway, they showed a clip from him discussing his legal situations from his home studio because he now basically, he doesn't have a job anyway, so he broadcasts up on YouTube. And anyway...
Not the new basement studios by the lake, but no, did it have a name? I don't know. Maybe you probably didn't see that much of it.
I wasn't. It's Bill O'Reilly. If I watch Bill O'Reilly at the most, I watch him with the sound down. But anyway, I noticed he's sitting there in what looks like his study, and he's got his desk, and he's got some equipment in front of him. But he has hanging in front of him the exact same microphones that you and I use here in the new basement studios.
Yeah.
We use blue microphones. They're called Yeti Pros. So quite hefty, looks very professional. We put ours on the table in front of us, but Bill O'Reilly had it dangling in front of him.
A big boom. Don't you say you have a boom at home, don't you, in your other home studio?
I have. Yes, I do. And I have, but I have another Yeti Pro at home.
You have another Yeti Pro?
Yes, I have a third one.
Okay.
And then I also have something called a Heil, H-E-I-L, but not to be confused with Heil Hitler. And that is a microphone that I have on a boom. Yep. And then I also have another one. I inherited one of those, I think they call them shotgun microphones.
Yeah.
Someone from my regular job, when they heard that I was podcasting, gave me a bag and said, here, why don't you take this stuff? Because we're not using it. And it was some mini portable mixer that I've never figured out how to use. And then the other thing was like a shotgun mic. So it's one of those long ones.
Yeah.
Long and thin. You'd I think they see, call them cigar mics or shotgun mics, or they have different names for them in the trade. I actually was fiddling around with it. I'd never used it.
Mm-hmm.
So I put it on a little stand the other week and I was fiddling around with it. I think I have been given a very expensive microphone. really good. I'm like, ooh, someone just gave me a cup. And again, these microphones, when we bought them, cost us about $100. Like I said, the one I have at home was $300, and this one, that I've inherited, it's got to be worth somewhere in there. So
I think our mics cost a little bit more than that, but yeah, about $150. They're somewhere in a reasonable range.
Yeah,
it's one of the more popular podcasting microphones, and ours. Anybody who's interested in this, they go as a USB connection, or you can go right into a soundboard. There's another Yeti that's silver that just has the USB, so it's really designed for computer use. And some people will get those even just for, you know, their Skyping and stuff, because it's just a better microphone overall.
So like I say, if you're thinking of getting into podcasting, these products are endorsed by both ourselves and, if it's of any worth to you, Bill O'Reilly. So
right. Speaking of technology, I guess.
It was something that came up this week.
So Amazon, you know, we've talked from time to time about all the home automation and, you know, Amazon Alexa and the Google Home. Yeah.
We also talked about Amazon Delivery, because you've used that groceries.
And like, so now Amazon just this week said, oh, this is exclusive to Prime members. I don't know why it matters whether they're Prime members or not, but they're offering
because we're already paying.
Yeah, but there's no reason that, I mean, it's just a product. It's called Amazon Key. And it's essentially a smart lock for your front door combined with a camera.
Okay.
The reason I say I don't know why it has to be Prime is, why can't anybody just buy this thing? I don't really know why you'd have to be a Prime member, but you'd be a Prime member and you get this. Well, the big hook to it is that you can now accommodate your Amazon deliveries, and the person delivering them can put them in your door.
Yep.
So it's set, like, if you get an Amazon delivery, I didn't catch whether the code is temporary. I think it is temporary, whatever it is. They'd have a code on the out, because it's got a touch key, and I'm sure it connects to Wi-Fi and does these things. So if somebody's doing a delivery, they know that delivery is coming. They even know when the delivery is coming. What I don't know is, are they using separate delivery people if you do this? Maybe that's why it's connected to Prime. You can only really use it for this purpose if you're a Prime member. So the theory is, and they make a big point of saying, the person will not come in. They will just open the door and slide the boxes in. It's not recommended for people with pets, because, you know, when the cat darts out the door while the person's doing it, or bites the person if it's a dog. I mean, the cat but that's less threatening.
I do have an affiliated pet story that I will get to.
Yeah, so they have this brass, and it's got a camera, and it also, in addition, because it's got this is what all the
What's
smart
it called again? Amazon
Key.
Just Key. Okay, yeah. Well,
yeah. Yeah, very innovative. Yeah. I think they also, you know, basically, if you're having a visitor, a guest come in from out of town, you can get, whoops, what's going on there?
Thank you for raising Illinois taxes. Oh, we had a technology foul up.
Well, it's like one of those things where you've got like a web page open and suddenly it's inside, it's going to play video. Yeah. Like this was some of the stuff we'll have later.
I can't decide if this is a really good idea or overkill. Now, I do get, apparently there is a whole, you know, sort of criminal enterprise that for years they stake out houses and remove the packages and then flog the stuff. So I think Amazon Key at a certain level in certain areas is probably going to be a really good thing. Then again, I would imagine if the criminal underworld are staking out your house to take your packages, then, you know, what's to stop them clonking the Amazon fella on the back of the head? And do you know what I mean? I don't know.
Right. Oh, now they open the door and I can get in there.
Go in and take
it. Lifehacker has an article basically says, don't jump just yet, you know, and it's not only that security issue, which people have talked about, this Internet of Things, all these devices that are now connected to the Internet, there's definitely concerns that things are, they create vulnerabilities in your Wi-Fi network, because now if that's tied in.
Wait a minute, hold on, run me by, how is this Wi-Fi?
Well,
it's tied into a loop. It's tied into,
because otherwise you couldn't tell the lock to open for this person. You wouldn't be able to see the camera. I think the camera's built into the lock or something like that.
Okay.
So it's obviously got to be connected into your local Wi-Fi setup. And just like any devices, your Wi-Fi network itself is generally quite secure. You know, if you're right from your home base, assuming you've set the keys and all that jazz. But the devices that tie in, because now they become a separate access point, is the concern is people can access. Like maybe somebody could access your Wi-Fi thermostat and therefore get into your system. You know, the thing is, when it comes to some of those
things, they can sweat you into submission. Well,
But no, the big thing is if they could get through that and get into your system and get things off your computer. And I've got family members who we put in a Wi-Fi thermostat. Oh my goodness, you know, somebody's going to hack into there. And I did make the joke about, like, you know, they're going to sweat you in,
sweat
or
cool us out,
or something like that. But, you know, also our houses have windows. I mean, our houses are very vulnerable.
prior to Wi-Fi.
Right, right. So that's the thing, is at some degree you go, okay, yes, you're right. A person could come here and hack into this system. Also, a person could walk around behind my house where nobody can see anything, knock out a window, come in,
yeah,
and steal all of my possessions.
Old school criminals.
But I still live life. I go on with that. So I'm not totally paranoid about this. But the other part they talked about is the camera security, because now you've got a camera running all the time. It's similar to the stuff we've had around the Echo, where that data, unlike on those Amazon devices, the Alexa and the Home, that data does not go to the internet until you trigger it to go to the internet. But this thing would always be feeding into the internet, because that's how it saves data. Like a Nest camera, the data that you sent, like those cameras that you have, home webcams,
yeah,
that data is always going to the internet. So if somebody could get into that, they can now see into there and that kind of stuff. Anyway, it's premature.
That's interesting, because I actually think it is situationally a really good idea. And you know, we've had this discussion on many occasions now since we compared, the Amazon and the Google Home devices. And I think we've both agreed that, you know, it is easier for both you and I as individuals to just order stuff off the internet. I would imagine, especially if this is a business, that if you're running a home business, mm-hmm, this actually would be a very good addition, sure, just for the sake of, I need this stuff, I need it secure because I'm doing whatever, or whatever it may be. I don't think it's the worst. I mean,
like all of these things, it's not ready, but it's all going there, everybody. You know, like, yeah, that's 20 years from now, well, we'd be shocked. If you ran into a house that just took a metal key, you'd be like, oh, how odd and old school. It'd be like a house that just had their wood-burning stove. It's not like you can't have it, but it'd be out of date for the technologies that'll be available 20 years from now. So the fact that this is starting off, you gotta observe.
Well, occasionally when we have our dog walked, we have a system with a company where they basically have their version of a realtor's lockbox outside the house.
Oh, yeah.
And then they open it, and they use the key to come in and get the dog. And then to prove that they've been walking the dog, they will send you a video of the themselves, yes, and then a quick report of what the dog did on his half hour.
That's very helpful. I could guess what those things are. But.
Well, yeah, I mean, at a certain moment, do I need to know that he peed four times? Yeah. Does it matter? As long as he went and he did his number twos, then I can't decide. I mean, this is a...
See, in my household, as you know, the podcast household has a double door situation in front, so this would actually be fine because the second door even locks. So there's, in a sense, there's a space in the front part of the
you
house.
You have an atrium.
Exactly. Where it's relatively secure. So somebody who opened that front door would not actually have access to the rest of the house. And so that would be actually a very useful product for here.
Yeah. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. And I'll actually
Maybe
will
I'll
say
get
this.
It. I didn't see what it cost.
I actually will say, what do you have any sense of what's happening with large apartment buildings with communal access ways and stuff like that? I mean, I'm sure they must have some system for that. But I would imagine if you live in a built-up area where, and let's face it, I don't want to get too deep into this, but I do think, you know, we talked before about criminals staking out your house. I also tend to believe that with boxes from Amazon, there's sort of the, I'm going to put this the right way, you're sort of chance a criminal who's just a regular bloke who goes, oh, I might take that box. Do you know what I mean? And like I say, so if you live in an area, a high residential area, it may not be the worst thing that there is that peace of mind of knowing that my delivery that I really need, especially if I've bought something expensive, that it's going to be there when I get home. Yeah. I mean, I had an experience recently with Amazon. It was the first time ever that something had not been delivered to me. First time ever, which I thought was actually quite... No, to be fair, I thought it was actually quite good. I've been buying from Amazon for years. I buy a couple of things a month. I thought it was great that after all this time, for only the first time, I never received something. I emailed the vendor, got a replacement sent out to me. No fuss, no muss. And so while that already exists, I'm giving Amazon a shout out here. They do a very nice job there of not challenging the fact that, you know,
at the margins, the fact that it happens that infrequently, given, and that's perfect.
I mean, that's a good
that's
thing.
Perfect evidence really of what I'm describing here, which is that it's not all that risky, you know, in the grand scheme of things. It turns out it's $250, But it's interesting. It's the home kit is $250. The kit includes Amazon Cloud Cam, which is the security camera.
Who installs the kit before you finish?
No, that's the second thing I'm going to say.
All right.
And a compatible smart lock from Quitsetter Yale. So in other words, it's not necessarily their proprietary smart lock. I think it's they're repackaging somebody else's smart lock.
Those are legit companies.
Oh yeah,
no, I mean it's not like and use our own rinky dink.
And then you can get free installation if you want it.
Okay, I don't think it's a bad thing. Somewhere. And it's $250 one
get
time.
Get the in-home kit installed for free.
Is it one time payment or so it's Prime plus the $250 and everything can come into
maybe apps. That's also where the Prime comes from. So like if you those webcams,
frankly, if the fella's there, I'd want to know if I could stop an extra $10 and he could walk the dog as well.
If you use a Nest webcam, you have to pay each year for storage of the data that it's the camera. So in other words, they're happy to sell you the product, but you know you're also saving a month's worth of video on their system, and they charge you for that. Some companies don't actually charge you, but that actually maybe that's the Prime connection. Is that like, well, we're not going to host all your video from your camera if you're not paying us whatever it is every year.
So did I hear you say that you would consider it?
Sure, of course.
Yeah. All right, I consider everything. But there's considering everything, being a very open-minded gentleman. And then there's actually going, I think I'm going to do that.
Well, you just asked me whether I'm considering it. I'm considering it. You didn't ask me whether I'm going to do it.
Well, are you going to do it then?
Probably not.
All right. All right. And so on to our next thing, staying with some technology.
Monorail.
Yeah. Well, actually, no, that's incorrect. It's Hyperloop.
Yeah, no. I was joking. You know, the Simpsons episode?
Yes.
Monorail. Written by, I believe, Conan O'Brien.
Conan O'Brien, yeah.
Hyperloop, which really just rolls off the tongue the exact same way as monorail, and it's a similar type of situation.
Except better.
It is better. So a Hyperloop.
Explain to everyone to start what it is. Well, actually, why don't we backpedal a little bit? There's been some talk in the news that Elon Musk of Tesla and, SpaceX and basically new age technologies.
Yep.
That he's either bought the rights or thrown down the money or he's done something.
So here's the interesting thing. So you started there, but I'm going to take us back over there. So a Hyperloop. Now let's talk about what it is, and we'll come back to Elon Musk.
Okay.
Hyperloop is a
tube in the ground.
Yeah, I mean it doesn't have to be in the ground, but you like the test ones are not in the ground, right? So the idea is it's similar. It's essentially a railway, not rails, but and we'll talk about how it moves through the thing. But is a low to zero pressure tube.
Yeah.
So you remove all the air, remove all the friction that arises from air, and you put essentially a vehicle in it, a car. Yep. You know, it looks like a train, but we'll talk about how it actually works in a second. And because it doesn't have any air to go through, and because of the things that we'll mention in terms of the way it works, instead of being on wheels, it
goes super fast.
It can theoretically go super fast. So the numbers that people have thrown out there, 600, 700 miles an hour. They talk about a trip from D.C. to New York in under 30 minutes. This should revolutionize. Elon Musk has said, it'll be the fifth mode of transportation, which I didn't see what the first four were, but I assume it's car, train, plane, and boat. That would be four main modes of transportation.
I'll give him that.
So then this would be a fifth mode. The reason I sort of took us back over there is because Elon Musk raised the idea originally, I think in 2013, as he said, this would be a thing. And but the reason I call it a loop is because it's going at high speed. While it could turn and stuff, but the idea is between a pair of cities, it would be, it's not like a terminal where it stop and turn around, and literally like loop around. So you could
blow. But it does stop
quickly. Yeah, it's got to stop.
It's not moving a loop. It's not like jumping on and off a Ferris wheel.
I saw videos that basically had it stopping and moving up like an elevator so that the loop itself would sort of separate.
Before you go on, I will actually embed in this post that comes with this show. I found on, I think it was on our local news website, WTOP, they'd embedded like a 15-second video of a Hyperloop test.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd actually warned, be warned when you click on this video if you experience dizziness or vertigo. And I'm like, seriously? A little 3x3-inch screen? So I then clicked on it, and it was basically just, you're in a tunnel and stuff is flashing by you. But I must say, I did feel a little unsteady.
Oh, there you go.
So I will embed that if
I can find out. So don't do that while you're driving. You're not supposed to watch a video when you drive anyway. But
no.
So, but he brought the idea up, but then he's treated as an open source item. So he doesn't really own a lot. He owns something that we'll talk about in a second that's associated with this. But the two main companies involved in this, I think one's called Hyperloop One, and that is a totally separate company that he doesn't have any ownership stake in at all. And then there's...
What's he involved in?
He just said, this is an idea out there, everybody. Let's all collaborate. And like the second main company that's involved in this is called... where's the thing? Shoot, I'm on the wrong Hyperloop page. There's another Hyperloop name thing, and that is actually crowdsourced. Like, there isn't even like a company. I think it's like an association.
Oh, I don't want to travel on that one. I'm not trying on the one that's been crowdsourced.
No, but this is the
This is not
the point. We're at the stage here where they're developing the technology, and what they don't want his fear is if you just have one company that has this stuff, it's not going to go anywhere. What you need is everybody to be in on it. And when you think about it, like rails, trains. There were different gauge rails, but at some point everybody said, well, let's all do it the same. You didn't make the railway system in a country 100% proprietary. Some historian could probably correct me on this. But so that's the idea. So it's in a tube, low friction. I originally thought it was like it had air pressure behind it. I used to have a
like
toy
like... pneumatic. That's why.
Right, that's what I thought. I had a toy like that I got for like holidays. Back when half the toys you would get that had interesting technology would not work. Like your slot cars, you know, you'd buy it and it would not work. I still remember to this day going back to the toy store where my father was telling the people they were taking this back because the thing didn't work. Anyway, it's not that. And then rather than wheels, there's actually multiple versions. And before we were on, you were talking about maglev as something separate. Well, one of the versions is actually a maglev in the tube. Right. So maglev, for people who don't know, is...
It's similar to a monorail. No, let me finish. You're looking at me like I don't know what I'm talking about.
I am looking like you.
It's similar to a monorail in that the train rests on a singular track.
Nope.
Maglev is, yes.
It's lev. And then it's all magnetic. It doesn't rest on anything.
It rests at the start. Then you hit the switch for full power.
Right.
All the electricity current goes in. And then because the rail and the little car you're on is magnetic, it raises up off the rail and sort of floats along the rail, unlike a monorail, which is attached.
I think you're creating specific distinctions. I understand. Like you could say that, but it's not like all monorails.
I'm not creating distinctions. I'm telling you what it is. I mean, at the end of the day, people can argue with the science, but that's the science.
Well, but maglev is a technology. It doesn't have to be a single rail. It can be multiple rails.
Are single rails. If you go to Germany and China where they already have this
rails. It's two things underneath have to balance it out. Okay. Anyway, so there's that version. And by the way, you should also mention in maglev, there's a... They call it a linear electric motor is one way. Because once it's off there, that doesn't propel it forward. So there's any number of ways you could propel it forward, but one of them is called a linear electric motor. Which, you know, if you've ever looked at electric motor, ones that might run your lawnmower or like a pump, it's a series of magnets and coils. If you unfurled that and made it flat, it'd be like running a motor along a rail so that the various magnets are propelling the item forward, just like it would normally turn torque on a motor. Anyway, so that's one version where it goes forward. The other technology is what they call an air bearing. Which is essentially, think about air
Is this
hockey.
Still maglev?
No.
We've moved off maglev.
Yeah, like that's
so
what
you're
I'm
confusing
saying.
Me now.
Right, but I'm saying maglev is one technology.
Okay.
And again, the point is no friction, right? Wheels have friction. Even though something rolls down a thing, it rolls, but there's friction and there's resistance that arise from the mechanical surfaces interfacing with each other.
Also, and I think this is important.
Axle to holder.
Before I let you continue, also there's no pollution. No, there's not.
Got to make the electricity somewhere.
Well, yeah, but there's no pollution from the vehicle. This is why these things are sort of attractive.
This is
why these things are attractive to the likes of Elon Musk as well.
Think about it this way. Maglev is a replacement for wheels on a road.
Yeah.
It's not a replacement for the motor. You may also have a magnetic propulsion system, but you could also have a fan on the back of it that ran off of a gasoline motor or something like that. But maglev, magnetic levitation, is instead of having wheels on the ground, or rails on
levitates.
Or wheels on a train track rails. Yeah. It's off. There's no
contact. But any pollution is back at the power station, which is always in the poor part of town anyway. So it's not like it bothers
pollution
me.
Doesn't have anything to do with pollution because wheels aren't in and of themselves pollution.
All right.
It's whatever propels the thing is pollution.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right.
So the other version is, it's another version of frictionless
transportation. Travel.
Again, no, it's not the pushing.
Motion.
It's the instead of wheels. It's the instead of wheels part. And that is what they call air bearings, which are essentially, think of air hockey.
Yes.
Yeah. You have air, you have push, it's an air cushion between things. And so most of, because it sort of connects into the low pressure of the tube, the one that people tend to think of more is that one. Although the main one, Hyperloop one, that I think is running out of California, they have a test track in Colorado. I think that's maglev in a Hyperloop.
That might have been the one that video that I saw. Right. Yeah.
But I think the people have also been talking about this air cushion one, where it would be just by, you know, you're just getting everything just a slight amount off of the surface by pushing air at high pressure out through little holes or something like that.
Have you seen the James Bond movie, The World Is Not Enough, with Pierce Brosnan and Denise Richards?
I don't remember which is which.
And they're in some tunnel on a machine, and there's a bomb, and I don't really quite know what's going on.
Doesn't it swerve around and stuff?
Yeah, and I can't decide.
If it does that, then it can't be maglev.
But it was Hyperloop. It was some sort of pneumatic thing.
They would have died if there was no air pressure. Weren't they, out in the open on the thing?
Well, only when it blew up. But that had something to do with the bomb, not the fact that the mode of transport. They were in some pipes.
Yeah.
I don't quite know what was going on there.
Anyways.
Sorry.
So there's that part of it in terms of technology. Those are all open source, and people have been working on different things. I'm sure people have proprietary
You just mentioned Hyperloop One in California. Is that different?
I think the company's in California, but Colorado is where they run the test track.
Yeah, and I think that's the video that was up on the internet.
I think that's right. Because they're the furthest along in actually doing something.
Who's paying for all of this?
Well, so in their case, somebody's, you know, there's some investors.
Okay.
But this is why the notion is some people are doing it. I'm sure they're patenting individual pieces and things like that. But the idea is let's all kind of put our heads together with ideas. What Elon Musk does own is what they call Something Boring Company or Something Boring Corporation.
Oh, yeah.
And this is...
He's got his angle.
This is one of these underground tunneling things, apparently separate. It can be used for this purpose, but it's used for lots of other purposes. I think in Asia, it's a big thing. And it's, you know, we've seen these pictures of these boring equipment that, do big tunnels. They'll do a tunnel under the
channel
water.
Tunnel,
yeah.
Subway tunnels.
So apparently the modern version of that is really much better than we might have seen in video before, where they can tunnel as little as 10 feet underground. In other words, they can just be just under the surface because it's designed to basically create concrete supports as it's going through there. And it can go a lot faster. And by faster, you know, we're talking about, you know, a certain number of miles over 6 months or something. You know, it's not faster in the sense of it's done.
I think they said
50 feet a day or something like that. I can't remember what it is. So he's got a company that does that. The deal that the reason this came into the news recently was because in Maryland, although the most recent article suggests that this stuff was discussed sooner than was anticipated, because maybe they don't have all the permissions they're supposed to, they have approved a test track that would run under 295, which is the Baltimore-Washington Parkway that runs between the two things.
Yeah.
I think for 10 miles, you know, obviously that's not far enough to go between Baltimore and DC, but it's a starting point of they're going to run this boring machine under there. And he's been out there saying he has all these permissions from people to go all the way from DC to New York. But, you know,
he says, do you trust Elon Musk?
Well, I trust him in the sense that, I know he's after this
Because let me tell you something.
But he's a salesperson too, and so he's saying, hey, listen, I got permissions, because probably somebody told him, yeah, we'll work with you. That's good enough for him. He doesn't have to have all the details before he talks about how he's going to do this.
I think he'd be a very good James Bond villain. He has that base where they build all the solar panels, and he's got his hands in all these different things, and he's got some corporation that does this.
They have those solar panels that look like shingles.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. And
although they're not the only company that does that.
And then really you could have a James Bond movie where James Bond kills him by throwing him off the Hyperloop and then says something about he had no need for speed or something
that. Yeah, so it says, we'll start with 2 35-mile tubes between Baltimore and Maryland. Company will have 10 miles approved so far and 215 more to get all the way to New York.
But the technology's real, though.
It is. Although a bunch of people have said, like, so that one in Colorado, it's going like 150 miles an hour. It's nothing like 600 miles an hour. And a number of people have said, it ain't. We're not getting 600 miles an hour out of these things.
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about that.
How fast but planes go anyway.
But plane goes, you know, plane goes 500 to 600 miles an hour.
Right.
And a Acela express train or any kind of American and British express train can go over 100 miles. You know, the TGV in France and the bullet train in Japan can do nearly 200 miles an hour. So yeah, to your point, unless the Hyperloop is actually quite convincingly, overwhelmingly quicker than what exists, then in a strange way, this isn't really a winning proposition. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit like, yeah, you know, everyone's riding two-wheel bikes, but I've invented a four-wheel bike. If it doesn't go any quicker, then no one's going to suddenly...
Right.
So, but apparently, though, the Hyperloop, the scientists claim it does have the potential to suddenly match aircraft speeds.
Yeah, or better. And plus, because it's all on this one route, the thought is... It's not going to be prone to accidents. I mean, even trains have a bunch of crossings and a bunch of pieces that can go wrong. But here, the thing is, it's all self-contained. Now, mind you, just think about, like, you know, a squirrel gets in halfway through there and the little air bearings, like, disrupt and, you know, the things
that go. Let me tell you something.
And people have said, the thing is, sure, maybe it's less likely that something goes wrong, but when something goes wrong in a tunnel...
Oh, I saw it.
That had a depressurized tunnel behind you that doesn't have any air in it. You know, like
There's no intermittent steps.
What's going to happen? Major disaster version. Anyway, so
that being said, if you're a squirrel and you're in the tunnel and you get hit by the Hyperloop train, I mean,
the real problem for American doing these things is because we are much more capitalist than other places, and they're in China, the government would just say, "We're doing this. All you people in the way, get your houses out of here. We're doing this thing, and we control all of the means." Of production and the like, whereas here you've got to rely on everybody to strike deals, to work it out, litigation, you know.
To your point, to the point you made prior to that, one of the things about that I do think makes this technology attractive, obviously, yes, if it can go quicker, then at a very base moment, the customer, that's the likes of you and me, are going to go, "Ooh, this is better. We need to get behind this." One of the other things about it is there is an opportunity at this moment in time for this society with its transportation network to actually start over and do it right. I mean, one of the biggest drawbacks about the railways is that, you know, in terms of where they've sat in history, the technology basically was always in front of whatever the infrastructure was, which is why, you know, Japan, that sort of had the opportunity to start afresh after the Second World War and earthquakes and that type of thing, were able to start with a bullet train system that is predicated on having straight lines and the best in technology. It is a lot more difficult for, you know, older first world countries like, you know, Great Britain or America. You already sort of you're trying to improve something that's already imperfect. And so, therefore, your rate of improvement is slower. One of the nice things about a Hyperloop is it would start entirely fresh. Like, it's not reliant on existing infrastructure. It starts entirely fresh. And so the opportunity would be to actually do it right and not have something that's constantly being jimmy-rigged. Like the railways. That's the biggest drawback about the railways.
Yeah, of course. The catch is, you know what the most likely place they would probably tunnel this thing underneath? The railway right away.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's if you want to get a path to New York and you want to tunnel everything, you don't need to go through neighborhoods. What you're going to end up doing is, like, going, okay, we have a train track. That's the thing I can... Or roads.
But what I'm saying is you can straighten up curves. You can, you know, you can use a bit more foresight than perhaps it's been used.
Couple last bits before we move on, because while Zeph was going on about that, I was able to look on the internet some more. The Hyperloop One is...
That's all tubes as well, the internet.
Hyperloop One, the company, is Virgin Hyperloop One.
Oh, it's just the same people mucking about, isn't it? Branson, Musk, they're always doing their things. None of these projects finish.
There must be a decent amount. Must be about a decent amount of money in here, because they've got a whole 75,000 square foot innovation campus in downtown LA. And all, what do you mean?
Now that I hear that he's involved, and I'm sorry.
And the other one, the one that's open source, is called Hyperloop Transportation Technologies. A group of more than 800 engineers and professionals located around the world. Some collaborate part-time, others are full-time, some members are paid, some others work in exchange for salary and stock options, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, I like Richard Branson as much as the next person. I deeply respect what he's done. But at the end of the day, his involvement isn't some sort of seal of success. He's been in the spaceship business. He's been racing motorboats. He's been flying balloons. All I know is I'm still going to work in my car and taking half an hour in traffic sitting to go 3 miles.
Other companies,
so I don't want to,
anybody's investing. Other companies are TransPod, which is Canadian, DGW Hyperloop, which is in India, Arrivo. Another LA-based company, Heart Global Mobility in Delft.
Where's I'm gonna say this: this is the chance. This is a good chance for the US to get out ahead of the game for once on this sort of thing. I mean, again, we mentioned earlier in our maglev discussion, they've already got maglev in China. They've already got it in Germany. You know, France, Japan are ahead of the curve in terms of high-speed trains. You know, here in America, let's get behind Elon Musk and let's get out in front of something first.
So we're already going through a lot of time here. You did have an article on
I just had a quick article though that there was for this area, the Washington D.C. area from which this podcast emanates, there had been discussion about the same time as these Hyperloop stories hit. That apparently in Prince George's County, which is a suburban county just outside Washington, D.C.
Maryland
side. And on the Maryland side, there'd been discussion about $10 billion to be spent on maglev. And the local council basically voted it down because they were like, we can spend this $10 billion on other things. As one council member said, quotes, it reminds me, frankly, of the Concorde airplane that has come and gone, unquote.
Yeah, and one of the things in there mentioned it being at grade. What I thought was the weirdest thing about that article is, and this is a recent article, this Hyperloop stuff was just in the news recently as well. I don't know who's the writer of this stuff. I don't want to say their name because I'm going to say his or her name. But
Max Smith.
Okay, Max. Max, if you were writing an article that talks about maglev and being shot down, the idea that you don't at least have a sentence that mentions in the same state that there was this thing on Hyperloop is just baffling to me. I mean, like, did you search the internet for recent news in transportation in Maryland, or do you read the newspaper? Because you should have said something that says, oh, and, you know, by the way, there's meanwhile this other thing. In fact, it would not surprise me at all if some of these maglev people were like, the people against maglev were like, why are we bothering with this? We're working on something that'll be underground.
Well, it says here, Northeast Maglev, which is a company, did get authority to use eminent domain to take properties for the project.
Right.
And that's what had caused the controversy, that they were snapping up projects. Does say that public meetings on this project are ongoing and more meetings are expected next year as part of the environmental review process. And I was actually a bit surprised that this wasn't, to your point about Hyperloop, that this wasn't an even bigger story. But at the end of the day, I will say this, to sum up, I will now sum up as some grand being from above making the final decision on all of this. It's good to know that people, and you know, I used to think that Hyperloop was some pie-in-the-sky sci-fi dream. You know, in the same way that on Star Trek, they can beam you down to the planet. I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, someone's always coming up with these things. But it is interesting that to sort of throw the council member's comment about Concorde back on her. Yeah, it may remind her of Concorde. Well, Concorde was real. And at some moment, well, what I mean is at some moment here, all of a sudden I'm sitting there going, ooh, maglev and Hyperloop, stuff that I never thought I would see, may well be nearer than we think it is.
It is a weird comment because what she seems to be saying is, like, people tried it and it didn't succeed. But that's anything futuristic has these, like, fits and starts. If anything, that's proof that it's more likely to be like, oh, wow, if we could create a Concorde that was people could use it and it's on the ground, you know, why wouldn't it be there? It's a very peculiar comment.
So talking of the future, let's segue to our next topic. Yeah. We're going to switch to entertainment. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the future that is envisioned by Blade Runner.
Yeah, Blade Runner. So we went to see Blade Runner.
We did. We went together.
2049.
And so, I had a brief moment when we went together. I briefly considered whipping out my phone and recording our instant comments, But then when you said, "Ooh, let's go and get a drink," I'm like, "Yeah, I don't need to."
we ended up discussing it. I almost wondered if we discussed it too much when we were having drinks.
I can keep it fresh.
I'm trying to see if I'm maxing out here, but
you're good. Don't worry about it. You were excited,
yeah,
because you liked the movie, didn't you?
I did like the movie, although I liked the movie. It's a long movie.
It's long.
It's 2.5 hours.
But you know, can I say
our little announcement said it was 2:45, but that was really with the previews.
It's a bit shorter, yeah.
2.5 hours, but it wasn't like long in the sense that. Well, that's not.
Well, no, I can. I'm going to. Well, you think to get your words. It's long, but you can go to the toilet and not miss anything because it's not long and fast. It's long and slow.
Well, but not necessarily. Like you're right. Both of us. Because
when I
took
my break and came back, I had missed anything.
Not a problem there.
Yeah. And I actually, as you know. Normally, going into a long film, I'm taking every precaution to not be in a situation where I needed to go. But strangely now, as I've got older, I'm like, yeah, I'm going halfway through the movie.
Right.
I'll have the biggest soda I can get my hands on because I'm going, so it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Until that gets to 2 times in a movie, then you go, well
then you're in problem. But if you can't hold it in, then really what's the matter?
But the when I say I liked it earlier, at the beginning better, it's not because of the length, but it was because... And I think you're going to talk a little bit about a variation on this theme.
Yeah.
They tried to fit so many things in there. Like, when they were writing this, it's a future sci-fi movie. And I would say it's even less sci-fi than it is what they call futurism. Like, you know, people who sort of are guessing what's in the relatively near future.
Where will this go from there?
So it's a perfect thing for a couple of the other things we're talking about, which are futurist types of ideas. But...
And I think that's an important distinction to make, though, because in terms of if you're the sort of person who's put off by sci-fi, the movie...
It's not sci-fi like laser cannons and lightsabers.
But beyond that, what I mean is it's not sci-fi in that the movie doesn't expect you to take certain leaps of faith for it to work. It's a very human story. It just happens to be set in the future. So to your point, it's not so much sci-fi, but it is futurist. I think that's quite...
Well, I mean, the technology things, which we'll talk about here in a second, but, that they show, you watch and you'd be like, okay, I can buy... It's not like Star Wars or something like that where you go, all right, I get the fact. Sure, that could be the case, but I'm just... We have enough grasp of the technology that when you watch this movie, you could say, okay, yes, there could be these replicants in the future that are essentially robots that you know are programmed and like, well, okay, I could buy that because
it's not relying on the Force or some Harry Potter wizard where you have to sort of go, well, I know that's not real, but I need to buy into it for the story.
The Blade Runner, and we're going to talk about the old one too. In fact, we probably won't talk that much about the recent one, maybe more about the old one. They're both spin-offs essentially of a Philip K. Dick who has done lots of futurist type of things. He's a sci-fi.
Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was the original short story.
Apparently, like the stories are very different at the end of the day, which we don't have to get into all that detail, but it was inspired by those.
Pretty much all Philip K. Dick stories. None of them actually take his story. They just take the idea.
Yeah.
Like Total Recall, I think that's based on his short story. We can remember it for Wholesale.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, it doesn't have Arnold in it, you know, really laying waste to half of Mars. But for some reason, Philip K. Dick and Arnold whacking 35 people in 2.5 minutes with a machine gun end up in the same movie. Is it interesting?
So the first 45 minutes of the new movie...
It felt like 45 days. No, it didn't.
45 minutes of the new movie, they were introducing these concepts right out of the gate that were really interesting.
Yes.
It's no secret that... The main protagonist, Ryan
Gosling,
is himself an android.
Like that's not a spoiler. They tell you that before
you go into the movie. He then, when he goes home, has a virtual reality
sort of
companion, spouse, whatever you'd say.
And it's kind of cool.
It's offered by the same company that makes him, basically.
Yes.
And then at some point he comes up with a version where you can now take it with you, but still this person is just a hologram.
Yeah.
And that my initial reaction on that was, well, that seems a little bit sort of interesting in the sense that, okay, it's like having a program, you know, that you could talk to on your computer. But then I realized, just like the whole notion of these androids, is that, well, at some point they become their own sentient. They're more human than human, as the phrase goes. Well, shoot, you don't need a physical body for that to be the case. And so now this what looked like in a much more inert type of program. Like, you could buy into an Android having a personality because it's got a physical presence, and you go, oh, you know, I can get my head around. That's kind of like when we talked about the dog-based robots, that you feel like, oh, it's like a real dog. And when you see something that's just a projection, you go, well, that doesn't seem the same. But why not, right? Why? I mean, if it's just programming underneath it, why can't something that's a holographic projection be just as much personality? And so I found those notions pretty interesting, because now you had these tiers. And in fact, they even played off of that with one of the characters basically making fun of the holographic character by saying that they're not a real girl, but the Android people were real, like in this world. It's like having like this caste system. So that's really interesting topics. You could do a whole movie on some of those topics, right? And like, and in some senses they did, because they now go over and, you know, there's different androids playing different roles, different people playing different roles, people who are semi-automated, the guy who's the boss of the company sort of semi-automated. But they then go, all right, we got those ideas on the table. Now let's throw in 18 more ideas. And the other ideas I don't want to give away, but they're new concepts that are like, ooh, what if this happened? What if this happened? And what if this was going on this way? And, oh, by the way, here's Harrison Ford. So then we have a whole other part on the back third, or back half, I guess, in the movie, when we run into Harrison Ford. And just the process of getting to him, they've got a couple of scenes where I feel like it's not the cutting room floor issue, although maybe it is a cutting room floor, but it's like they wrote so many ideas into the thing that were all legitimate ideas, and they ultimately decided, heck, leave them all in.
Well, this
and
is
I think it would have been better with 75% as many ideas.
I thought it was a very entertaining film. It was long. Visually, it was...
Yeah, I mean, visually, it's
visually
great.
Visually arresting. I'm not a big fan of Ryan Gosling. I thought he was terrific. But my biggest criticism of the film, to the point you've just made, it laid out all these great ideas. And then, unfortunately, Harrison Ford shows up. Not a criticism of Harrison Ford. And all of a sudden, you feel that questions... I think there's a thing that if you're going to do a sequel to a movie that's 20 years ago, then at some moment it exists because of the movie 20 years ago. So rightly or wrongly, it does ultimately need to resolve. It resolves itself. It's a sequel for a reason. It's a sequel of a movie 20 years ago. So its existence has to resolve any questions you were left from 20 years ago, or somehow has to work as part two of a two-part story.
I think they could have done separate.
No, but what I'm saying is, if you do a totally separate movie, then people are going to come in and go, I thought this was called Blade Runner, or what about Harrison Ford, or whatever it may be. And I'm being trite when I say that, but I think in a strange way, the movie's biggest undoing is that it is connected to a movie 20 years prior, because to the point, on a very base level, I think, I'm not a big fan of Ryan Gosling. I thought he was terrific. It's his movie for about an hour and 45 minutes. He's the only character that we follow around. We see the futuristic world through his eyes. You know, everything, talking about his holographic partner, everything about him, we see it through his eyes. The minute Harrison Ford, and I don't mean this as a criticism of Harrison Ford, but the minute that the lead character from the movie 20 years ago shows up, then all of a sudden, I almost felt that Ryan Gosling suddenly got left at the door, and we were suddenly in a different storyline, and that was the worst thing about this film.
Yeah, not 100%, but you did have that intrusion.
A lot of the themes that you threw up, I felt, were never quite resolved as well as they could have been.
Edward Jay Olmos makes an appearance, and he's from the original movie as well, and he makes an appearance that I think was appropriate for somebody who was coming back. It tied in some strings and threads there, but you know, they didn't like keep him around, and then they went to Harrison Ford. And to be honest, that movie could have been done completely without Harrison Ford. Like, you didn't need him at all.
Yeah, I think it would have been great.
Work. I mean, it's not that.
But they had
to service too many different things the way they set it up.
And, well, so let's talk about the old movie, because ultimately, I think I'm of the position that the thing that holds the new movie back is the old movie. And now,
A couple of factual things so people know. Like, so basic data we always like to run over. This movie, the new one, was directed by David...
Denis. It's Denis Villeneuve.
Denis, sorry.
You actually said Denis.
All right, I'm going to say Denis.
No, it's not Denis. It's not Denis.
Villeneuve.
It's Denis.
Whatever.
That's how anyway, he says it.
I don't care.
He's got a girl's
Rio
name,
Grand. Denis. You know, I just call it my own way.
Villeneuve.
Anyway. He directed it. He's also...
Which is French for nine villages.
He directed, speaking of stinky sci-fi, Arrival. with that alien
Amy Adams
coming in there. Also directed Sicario.
Good movie, that one.
Yeah, that one's very
good. Very different movie, too, though.
And Prisoners is one that people always talk about and I haven't gotten to see it yet.
That's with
Jake Gyllenhaal.
And the Australian, what's his name? Logan.
Yeah.
I've forgotten his name and I can see his face. Anyway, Hugh Jackman.
So, you know, well-directed. Like we said, technically, this movie is very well done. And I'd imagine he wasn't making the... I don't think he was making the edit choices. I'm not... Well, maybe he was. I guess he must have been making it some little... Written by... And this is what I found interesting. It's written by Hampton Fancher.
Who also wrote the first one.
And you expect to see somebody who, like... And the first one's in 1982, so 25 years, basically.
Ridley Scott movie. Right?
35 years.
35 years,
between the two. You would expect this guy to have a...
To have moved on.
Moved on. But you'd think somebody who wrote the original one, although he was sort of replaced on the first one, which we'll come back to, would to have a full writing history. And he does not. I mean, he's acted. There's a bunch of acting roles, of very low-level acting roles. But his writing credits between here and there are next to nil. He did The Mighty Quinn, which I don't know.
Denzel Washington. Which is actually set in the Caribbean.
That was in 89.
Yeah.
But literally, his writing credits are Blade Runner, Mighty Quinn, Blade Runner video game, The Minus Man, I don't know what that is, Blade Runner 60 Director's Cut, which is just a short. There's a couple of shorts between these movies that he wrote, and then this Blade Runner movie. And
maybe he's committed to his life of selling life insurance.
I guess. I mean, like, so I watched
we
part
do
of this.
On
so
the
as,
side.
As, mean, as we're going to turn back to the old movie... in preparation for this, I already had, although I never really watched all the parts of it, in 2007 they put out the Collector's Edition, which had the original theatrical release of the movie.
Yep.
The international theatrical release.
Which is the same thing, except it's a bit more violent.
Yes.
A bit more graphic.
They had an initial director's cut. They called it a director's cut, but
which
apparently
Ridley Scott
is the director of the first one, who we'll talk about more in a second. But they then had a true final cut, they called it, which is a real director's cut, which was done by Ridley Scott. Then it had a whole bunch of extras and outtakes, like typical. It had what they called a work print, which was before they put out the first theatrical print. It's what they test ran before audiences. And then they also had like a whole making of the thing, which I at first I tuned in. It turns out it's like 2.5 hours of making of stuff. And I'm like, I haven't gotten through all of it, called Dangerous Days, which was one of the original names for the script before it went around.
Okay.
So where was I going with that? David Fancher is on that. He talks about it a lot. I forget what my point was.
Okay. I'm going to say this. I think it's important.
Ridley Scott, for people who don't know.
Alien.
He's done, obviously.
Prometheus.
Much more.
More Alien
thing.
Movies. The Duelists. A couple of movies with Denzel Washington. And Russell Crowe. A Good Year with Russell Crowe. The one American Gangster with Russell Crowe and Denzel Washington, which is great. He's also done... What's the one with Russell Crowe and Leo DiCaprio about the CIA operative and... It's set in the Middle East. Mark Strong is in it.
Syriana?
No, it's not Syriana, but it's around the same time. It's actually a very entertaining movie about, you know, Western involvement in the Middle East. It was done well after 9/11, but it was done prior to Zero Dark 30. But it's all very good in there. I wish I could remember what it's called, but I would recommend that. State of the Enemy or so. Anyway, that's very entertaining. But he's done a lot of work with Russell Crowe.
That's supposed to Enemy of the State.
And, yeah. I think so, the original Blade Runner.
And so I know what I was thinking about was that the writer in that original one turned over, like they basically replaced him, I think, on the writing.
Yes.
Like we talked about. He did continue to get a credit, but he wrote it a certain way. And David Webb Peoples ended up doing the final version of the writing of that. And he did 12 Monkeys, Unforgiven, some other movie, Hero, not as much, Lady Hawk back in 1985.
Yeah, there you go. It's a classic for you.
So I just found it fascinating that this person did it. So that we turn back to the original one.
The original is a cult movie. It's also one of the most overrated cult movies. I'm going to tell you, I think it's
broader
a cult movie.
Than a cult movie now.
I don't think it's that broad.
By the way, I should point out, anybody who wants to see the new movie, if you're into that, you'll like it. I mean, like, listen, we gave it a hard time, but you'll definitely, it's definitely worth seeing, especially in a big theater. I mean, like,
yeah, no,
cool
do look. Go and see it. It is an old fashioned throwback visual big
watch,
screen entertainment.
You should probably watch the first one again if you can beforehand. I don't have to. I mean, if you remember, basically, but it's helpful as long as you're going to
tie I think it helps, but this is, again, the biggest letdown of the new movie is the notion that somehow it's tied to that old movie. I think the old movie is one of the most overrated films. I find it curious that it has the reputation that it does. It is visually arresting. Harrison Ford is very good. It's extremely well cast. The villain is Rutger Hauer, who is terrific.
I think I'll let it.
Again, it looks amazing. It's very slow, quite dark, and I'm not quite sure what's going on.
What's the part that's overrated?
But the fact that it's slow and I don't quite know what's going on, and at the end of it, I'm not quite sure what the point is. I do find it an unbelievably frustrating movie. I find, like a lot of, all of Ridley Scott's films, there's a criticism of Ridley Scott now, they all look amazing. Mm-hmm. The guy started his career doing commercials and music videos back in the United Kingdom. All his films, you look at them, it just looks great. And I know that's a very sort of facile way of saying it, but it looks, there are images and atmosphere, they look fabulous. Blade Runner is 99% atmosphere and basically 1% of this sort of old-fashioned detective story that's kind of halfway lost. And really, it's supposed to be film noir, but it's bad film noir. And if I want to watch film noir, then I'd rather watch a movie from the 1950s. What's the great one? Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, which is classic film noir. I think
your mistake is thinking it is a film noir detective movie. It has the cues.
But it's not science fiction. We've just established that. It's futurism, but it's not science fiction. So, see, I've defeated you with your own argument.
It is a...
a masterful piece of debate right there. It
is a principled art piece.
And then they call an art piece is crap.
No.
I'm sorry, it is, because it's not a very good film.
It is an excellent film.
It's like 2001.
I would have thought your flaws were going to be that some pieces of it were not technically as good big a deal, or the acting was off. I mean, Sean Young's acting was a weaker link, but that was on purpose in some respects. I mean, they tried to pick somebody who kind of didn't know what was going on.
But I think Harrison Ford is good. I don't think he's great as everyone says he is. I mean, Harrison Ford, and it's interesting when you watch the movie and you lent me the Blu-ray and I watched it again the other week. It is difficult with any old film.
I mean, the best one in the whole movie, which I was fascinated by when I read it, watched a second, that was Rutger Hauer.
He's
like,
brilliant.
Like, he's like, it's like.
And you do know his big speech at the end.
Yeah, he made it up.
Then he showed it to Ridley Scott and said, I want to do this. And Ridley Scott said, oh, okay, go for it. And he did, and it's brilliant. I mean, to come back to Harrison Ford, the hardest thing about Harrison Ford in anything now is to watch it. Because he's at the point of his career where we've seen all of it, it's very hard to watch it and think what it was like watching it at the time. What I mean is you can never watch Harrison Ford and subconsciously not put him in reference with everything else.
He was already a star at that point. He had already been filming. I don't think it was out yet, but when did Raiders come out?
Raiders came out in 81. So Raiders was about the same time.
Because at the time they were casting this, he was in London filming a bunch of that or working on the show.
You told me that apparently one of the names that was up for the lead part was Dustin Hoffman.
Yep, that's on these things, so anybody wants to see that. Well, the point where they had extensive meetings with him and he was re-steering the story.
Yes.
Like they even did some mock-ups where like it was his drawing and like now he was going to, he obviously is not as much of a physical presence and not quite as film noirish, but I think it was more, he was going to be more introspective. And at some point they basically said, wait a minute, we're not rewriting the movie with this guy anymore. And so they moved a different back.
There was someone else who was big at the time who did. Because there is another name that we're going to come to.
There's a brief flash where they talk about ideas and it includes like Burt Reynolds,
that's right.
Like there's things.
There's a couple of other names.
I don't
names
think that any of those people were really, like, I think they were on a person's list somewhere and said, oh, we should talk to these people. Not that, like, they screen tested for it or anything.
But
like
the writers did say they'd written it for a Robert Mitchum type, which was why he was one of the first names on the list. Because, again, the guy's playing, like, sort of a private eye, and it is influenced and wants to echo old-fashioned film noir in terms of a sort of slightly rumpled loner detective and a femme fatale and this notion of other forces at play. So what I'm saying is I can understand why, okay, you want an older guy and Robert Mitchum, who's played Philip Marlowe on screen. In a strange way, it is a Philip Marlowe. It's a Philip Marlowe story set 200 years into the future.
Yeah, so anyway.
But Dustin Hoffman, no.
Yeah. We've gotten distracted from the point, which was I was explaining why this movie is better.
Elaine!
I think you make a mistake to think of it like it is in fact a detective movie, because there's mild mystery as to what's going on, but it's not really a detective movie. It's not like a bunch of twists. It has that.
And I can't get past
that. It is a process. Well, but I'm going to help you here.
It's too late, my friend.
It's framing it up in there, framing up in that guise. But at the end of the day, it is a rumination on what it means to be human.
Sure.
That is interesting. That is much more interesting than any plain vanilla detective movie or Western or things like that.
Yes.
So it's big topic. Like, listen, it is like prog rock, basically.
Which is crap.
It isn't crap. I mean, I just watched the documentary on Dark Side of the Moon. Dark Side of the Moon. Like, I'm just going to listen to that 20 times in a row, because when you actually start thinking about what Dark Side of the Moon is, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, you're like, that is one of the greatest albums of all time.
If you listen to Dark Side of the Moon backwards, it's actually Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore, but there you go.
I don't know where that comes from. But anyway, so like you have this protagonist who starts off by being I just go out there and get them. He's almost not human in his sort of indifference. You have a set of the pursued people who have a limited life, and this is where Rutger Hauer's stuff is really fascinating when you watch it a second time, that he is childlike and impetuous and confused. And even though, like, the first time I ever watched it, or first times I watched it, because I watched it a gajillion, technical term, you just thought, oh, he's like a imposing big guy with blonde hair, and he's like just intense, and he's like tough and strong, and he's pursuing him. But then when you watch all the bits and pieces, he's like his all over the map, like in terms of being. He's a kid here because he's this new. He's literally trying to find out what's going on, and he finally finds out. And because he can't handle, he kills his father, his god, basically.
Yeah, he's an artificial being attempting to find his humanity.
And then he cycles around, and like he ultimately, I mean, he obviously could have killed Harrison Ford 2 times over, 12 times over, whatever it was. And he ultimately comes to terms with who he is in some sense, or his fate, let's say, maybe not who he is, because he sits there and he says the time to die, which is the greatest thing about that movie one of the greatest things is they have that time to die line twice in the movie. One time when Harrison Ford's getting beaten up. And through this whole process, meanwhile, Harrison Ford is striking up a relationship with an android who he would have just
dismissive,
and then he ultimately comes around. And then, of course, the great mystery of this, although like in recent years, when it first came out, this would have been much more of a rumored thing. Is Harrison Ford himself an android? By the way, they're called replicants in this, because apparently android was like too cheesy a word, I guess, in the early 80s or something. It's funny, in retrospect, it doesn't seem like that, but at the time, maybe it's because of Star Wars, because they talk about droids and they didn't want things to sound like
droids. Because people were thinking of like Robbie the Robot and so R2-D2, they wanted it to be more, these are very human-like things.
So he comes around to a point where he is a different person after coming through this system and runs off with the replicant person. And that is what ultimately feeds into the new movie. But the new movie really doesn't explore that humanity. It's a different thing that the new movie's exploring.
Well, and that's why I kind of like the new movie better. I do feel that the new movie's interesting because it's stated up front that the lead character is a replicant. And so therefore you suddenly have a sense of perspective from which to watch things. And the new movie deals in, without giving too much away, the replicant unsure, becoming more unsure of whether he is a replicant, which is an interesting journey to be on.
He still thinks he's a replicant, but he thinks he's something special.
That he's something special.
He thinks I'm special, and it turns out he's maybe not special, or maybe he is special, but he ultimately...
And here's the thing I found, because the very original cut of the movie, and even the later cuts of the first movie, leave it relatively ambivalent as to what Harrison Ford is. The power of that revelation or non-revelation is therefore muted, because you're not quite sure. You're not quite sure what you're supposed to think. Whereas, you're correct. I find Rutger Hauer's sort of, not transformation, but realization as to his own existence far more. Second time around when I watched it, not second time around, I've watched the movie many times, but when I watched it recently, I really appreciated his character's journey. Harrison Ford still seems to be this weird cipher of a detective or whatever. And it's interesting, Ridley Scott has said, oh no, Harrison Ford's character is a replicant. And Harrison Ford goes, no, he's not. And you're sitting there 35 years later going, there's a part of me going, yeah, all these dudes that made this movie still didn't know what they made. So I'm supposed to somehow sit here and go, it's a good movie? Absolutely not. The second one is much better.
Well, it's fine. I don't disagree necessarily, although I think the first one was certainly
look out more. The first one first is probably one, well rated on Rotten Tomatoes, but financially took forever
to the make first one is back. Obviously much more cutting edge because it was new, and the other one had the you know, you may not like that it's beholden to the old one, but it's also standing on the shoulders of the old one, so you can't give the new one as much credit for breaking new ground.
No, that's true.
It's better made.
Here's the trouble with the old one, and I'm now going to actually use the fact that there seem to be upteen versions of it out there. I don't think anyone at the time really knew what they wanted it to be or were able to
It changed like 12 different times.
That's what I'm saying. Or were able to be committed to what they wanted it to be. Maybe the director wasn't allowed to make the movie.
Well, I think the big difference
But let me finish. But even six versions later, people still don't quite know what it's supposed to be. And so at that moment, maybe we're trying to make chicken salad out of chicken dropping. I mean, I know it's a rather extreme and quite unfair criticism, but, you know, at a certain moment, I actually don't have to look at the Mona Lisa 60,000 times to get it. Do you know what I mean? If something is supposed
Mona
to be...
Mona Lisa, that's the if most thing, overrated art ever.
But if something is supposed to be great artistically, then by rights, you're getting it the first or second or the third time. With Blade Runner, listen, still 35 years later, so the people who made it are arguing about what it is.
You are a big movie. Boom. You are a movie industry fan. You're interested in the things. You always, off the top of your head, who directed, who did this stuff. I always got to look all that up, figure out what else they directed. You should find,
my friend.
This is a class, like on a meta level, it's how do you get art, movie theater art made? And a bunch of things that went into it. The voiceover is the one, like, just
for simple. But my point is, they didn't end up with art. That's my criticism of it. You can keep retrolling
stuff. Sure, it's still art.
I don't think it is. It's not great art. Sorry. It's
not classic art. Which version are you saying is... Like, so, let me finish the thing about the voiceover, right?
Do it,
so the voiceover is the classic thing that when they originally did the movie, when they had the screen print,
the very which first watch, one.
There's no voiceover. Because, in fact, the guy had written it with a voiceover.
Yeah.
And Harrison Ford, when he came in there, said, this is ridiculous. Why am I explaining this stuff? We can do stuff. So they actually sat down and hammered out scenes that would explain things that would have otherwise been in the voiceover. They create the screen print. The test audiences go, I'm confused, kind of like that.
There you go.
So they go, well, we better put that voiceover back in.
I talk for the everyman.
The voiceover, if anybody has listened to both, if you listen to one with the voiceover and you listen to the one without is definitely better.
You know, it's funny. I used to always like the one with the voiceover, but haven't watched it now, haven't seen it many times, and watching it now, I like the one. I like it as it is.
And it's
now.
Mostly because the voiceover is very wooden. Like, it's very, like...
Well, he didn't want to do it. He was dragged to the studio.
Like, he claims I tried, but script-wise, it's very odd things that, he was speaking this thing, and it was this oddball. You know, the dialogue is not well written for the voiceover itself. So that's a classic case. So they got shoved into that. I don't think Ridley Scott would have ever wanted it in there.
He didn't want it.
But he had to concede on having it in there. So this is... Something can be art, but because so many hands, like a painting, the Mona Lisa, somebody paints it. They don't have somebody who goes, okay, thanks for painting that. I'm going to go over your version with a new thing, and I'm going to put this around different. Oh, by the way, I want to add some background here. And gosh, we don't really know what she's doing here. You know, it's a singular vision. Movies just aren't singular visions.
No, and I get
you know, they got so many other people involved in there. So I think it can still get credit for being art. I mean, ultimately, listen, I'm going to force us, and this is going to work out pretty well because everybody gets totally sick of us, can stop listening shortly. But I'm going to still stick with the idea that it's worthwhile. And for you to say it's the most overrated cult film ever.
Far and away, yes.
Compared to what? Which one is what overrated cult films are less underrated that you're saying that this is the worst one?
I don't know. One of those John Hughes movies.
What do you think about Donnie Darko?
I actually enjoy that a lot.
Yeah.
And I've seen both versions of that. And I never saw it in the theater, and I only saw half watched it the first time, and then I watched it again. I thought that's brilliant.
Here's what I'll tell you. Here's the most overrated cult movie ever. Clockwork Orange.
I don't think so.
There's no... This movie, Clockwork Orange, is way blown up past How could you say that?
Let's not go. It's fine.
It's interesting, but it's.
I understand your notion that now everyone's had a chance to rejig Blade Runner. They have created something that ultimately fitted the original vision that they were not allowed to do. My point, though, in watching that film the other week in its now hopefully final version, is we're left with a pretty run-of-the-mill detective film noir. Guy searches for a girl. Some other people get in the way. It's set in the future. No. It looks great. And because no one wants to commit to the big revelation, which should be the guy who thinks he's a human is in fact a robot who's fallen in love. Because you don't commit to that finish, you walk out of the movie going, well, there you go again. I like the second one more because it is more upfront about just where all the furniture is standing. And I do feel that's my criticism of Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner. Even now, after all this time, you and I had this discussion. Do you think he's a replicant or not? And my answer is, well, you can argue it both ways. But in a strange way, the rest of the film is not strong enough where arguing about it is worth my time.
See,
I don't care about his character.
I think your problem... I need to think back about the other things you've analyzed.
Hit the drum. Where's the bell?
You do not appreciate ambiguity enough. That I don't know what you think about paintings.
No, but I challenge Blade Runner. I don't think Blade Runner is ambiguous. I think it's just there. It doesn't make a compelling enough argument either.
But you're complaining because it didn't commit to saying.
Well, no, but it's argument.
It didn't have a big reveal that he was an android or wasn't an android. And I'm saying it's better for not doing that.
No, because then when I watch it, I don't think he's an android.
Okay, that's great. Art is supposed to elicit a different reaction from different people.
But my reaction is I don't quite understand what the conversation's about. There's nothing in my mind that he's not a human. So therefore, the whole this movie's going to make you talk. Well, it's not making me talk. There's nothing about it where
rattle off a half a dozen things that make it apparent that he is an android.
Okay. Well, he is an android, apparently, because the director says he's an android. So at that moment, well, there you go. The writer said this is what it is.
But the actor says he's not. Like, the actor wasn't playing him as an android.
And this is why I'm glad Harrison Ford's not in movies anymore.
But this
he spends too much time arguing. He kept saying George Lucas didn't know he was talking.
This is what's fascinating about the movie, right?
So do your
The fact that Harrison Ford is saying that I'm not an android, I didn't act him as an android. Well, that is...
He's no smarter than me, if that's the case.
But this is perfect, because it aligns exactly with the notion is that whether he's an android or not, Harris, the character, Deckard, thought he was a real person. So the whole point of Harrison Ford acting like a real person is perfect.
Now we're just getting meta to be meta, and I get frustrated by that. At some moment, a story does have to stake out its ground. Otherwise, it's just a doodle.
One of the plans for whenever we get around to having this party for our reunion is we were going to have a little game about talking about what's right and what's wrong and what's better and what's worse kind of thing.
We might do that in the live show.
We're going to have to talk about that.
All right.
So, all right. So, listen, I'm going to pause here. So, we went directly into the big questions.
Okay, do it.
So I'm going to, we're now at an hour and 11 minutes, and I appreciate that this is long. So I'm giving, if you are into this, are you into the Blade Runner or things like that, hang around here. I got at least 20 more minutes to rattle off here about different bits and pieces
of
it.
But if not, take care.
But if you're not, that's fine. You're like, good night, take care. Yeah, I'll just say, you can go somewhere else and listen to something else. But so bits and pieces, because I've been watching all these versions over and all. I always find interesting is when movies have themes. I don't always pick them up the first time around and need some cues. So eyes, obviously. Eyes are a huge thing in this. And we have, the very beginning shot is an eye.
Yep.
And they test them by looking in their eye. Yep. And there's eyes that are pulled out. And they go to the eye manufacturing guy in order to find out more about where they're supposed to go. And every time you'd see an android with a little... They have the little reflection behind their eye.
Steven Spielberg in Minority Report. That's one of the big key twists there is he has to get his eyes changed and that whole scene.
I thought it was backwards. Yeah. But there's versions where the animals and you have a reflect. You know when you see a dog's eyes at nighttime and has a golden reflection.
They have all the shots of the owl.
Now, mind you, side note, if it was that obvious that androids had these golden eye reflections.
Yeah, we wouldn't need Harrison.
And also, by the way, here's what I'm going to give it some critique on here. The guy opens up the computer, the cop, the chief, which by the way, if you're looking for situations where much more subtly seems to be a hint that this guy's an android, his entire conversation when he's looking at Harrison Ford, it's very much like it's not like looking at a regular person. It's like looking at this person and trying to make sure they don't realize they're an android. But anyway, separate point okay. on there. But they pull up the computer and they show these graphics of the android models. Yeah. Oh, here's Rutger Hauer and here's Pris and all this sort of, you know, like the bits of that. Well, if they know what these androids look like, why do they need to run these tests? Like, every time they go, they're going to sit down there. I forget what they call it. It has some test. It's not the Case-Shiller test, which is the personality test or whatever.
It's the Briggs-Cheney test, yeah.
Well, that's the real life company thing. Yeah. But they have a test, and it has some name. And, like, oh, we ask these questions in order to figure out if somebody's an android. And I understand that, like, Sean Young character, Rachel,
that's why
we don't know who
text.
She is yeah. for the test. But the guy who's tested at the beginning, who is just a laborer from one of the off-world things, who then ends up shooting the first Blade Runner at the very beginning.
Yeah.
They knew what the guy looked like.
Well, but they had all this stuff. But it's about being sure that they're a robot.
What? Like, because there's a bunch of people who look exactly like the robots that you have pictures of already?
I mean, people design things to an ideal, don't they?
I always love this because I take a contrary position, and now I've got you in a position of arguing for the merits of the way the movie is done in this regard.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, so there's that piece. And the other theme that
I'm sticking up for logic
is fans. There's ceiling fans all over the place, which, by the way, nobody's going to have ceiling fans. And the original Blade Runner is
supposed to be that hot and sweaty in L.A. And
but it's not very accurately futurist. Like that movie is supposed to be set in 2019, by the way.
It's supposed to be set 50 years into its future, basically.
Two years.
Yeah.
And so the new movie is 2049 is a big part of that. But, like, listen, there's not going to be a bunch of ceiling fans in the buildings. There's not a bunch of ceiling fans now.
There's not ceiling fans in the new one. Yeah.
Whereas their streetscape, you could kind of buy in a rundown city, you'd have all these things going on. There's also the fans on the roof of the building at the very end shot. You know, this, you may not remember it, but there's like a ton of fans and they're vertical. They have no purpose unless maybe they're little windmills or something like that, because they're just fans on top of a building that are standing up.
You're thinking too hard about some of it.
I'm talking about themes, though. I don't know. Like
the eye theme
obviously has to do with eyes, the window to the soul and all that stuff. I'm not sure what the fan supposed to be. But
this is the trouble with
there's no
movies.
Chance Ridley Scott didn't have a reason that he wanted to have fans all over the place. And I think
it's more than that.
Now, they did do a lot of, they mentioned like lights through, apparently that was not a typical thing, was the light projection through slats and things like that. But there's so much of that in that movie, it's like crazy. What bugs me about those things is that that's not the way light usually comes. It's almost as bad as when people stand in front of computers on movies, and whatever it is that's on the computer screen is projected on their face or on the back.
Because
that's not way a screen works. Like, it's not like if I'm reading something, you can read the words on my face. It just, you know, it's just light, you know. Anyway, tons of smoking. They smoke all the time. Everybody's smoking, but nobody smokes in New 2049. So sometime between 2019 and 2049, they banned smoking.
Because it's film noir.
But I'm just saying,
that's
these are funny bits and pieces. Tyrell Corp is the company that runs this stuff in the first one. By the way. And it supposedly in between the two goes bankrupt and somebody else
buys it up in the second one.
Tyrell's not the same company that ran the stuff in Aliens, was it?
No, that's the Weyland Utami Corporation.
Okay, all right. It just sounded too much like it. I was like, that'd been really cool if it kind
that's
of,
why
kind of tied
Guy Pearce's character in the new Alien movies is John Weyland.
It's one of the first movies that does the enhanced thing. A bunch of people are claiming it is the first movie that goes, like, when they're looking at a video, they go beep, 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 enhance that. Beep, 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 enhance
maybe,
that. Now, it doesn't do the enhanced version like you now see on, like, CSI, where something is completely blurry, and on the movie, like, on a TV show, they'll be like, enhance that. This is much more like, zoom in.
Blow it up. On Star Trek, they do that.
I liked how in the new one, for their photos, they had, like, paper photos, but they moved. Like, so that's what you could see being a future for things. Whereas in the old one, they literally had paper photos.
Well, again, that's homage
in 2019, obviously,
nobody's
walking around in 2019 with a bunch of paper photos.
No.
So they all just have it on their phones. I'm trying to remember if they have phones there. All right, so here's another flaw in the movie. And this must be just having to do with 82, although I believe they basically felt like they had to ape this in the new movie. Just okay. Sexy time. You're like, you know, they got to have a big old hooking up scene between Rachel. And apparently, like, one of the producers on a thing says they wanted more of, like, you know, the Sean Young and him hookup kind of thing.
Oh, in the first movie.
There's a version with a cut where they have some scenes I think they cut out of the final thing where Sean Young, you can actually see her. She's okay, half she's, naked yes, and right. the like. Well, you know, I gave when I watched the original one, I go, it's 1982. Everybody feels like they need a little love scene kind of thing.
Okay.
But then the new one, they have that love scene where I almost felt like it was because they felt compelled to have a love scene that aligned with the first one. Remember where they like synthesized the two people?
I don't know. I actually felt that was the time.
It didn't ring as hollow.
No, but the time in the second movie, I'm like, oh, we're gonna get stuck in this now. But
they cut away from it very quickly, which was good.
But in hindsight, it's actually I thought it was a really important part of the film in the 2049. The notion of at some moment you can interact with an object. Or you can interact with a presence. In this instance, Ryan Gosling interacting with his hologram girlfriend / companion. But at some moment, these things need to be humanized. And that was, to me, the point of that.
It did feel like somebody was like, oh, we need to have a hookup scene here. How can we fit this into the plot? The time to die I mentioned before. I do wonder why, like, if these... these robots, like Rucker Hauer is supposed to be this big warrior robot or something like that, right?
Well, he's very violent.
Yeah.
And you can tell he's powerful. And
for whatever reason, like he decides to stick nails in his hand at the end because his hands aren't working well. I'm not quite sure how he feels that's going to fix his hand by sticking nails in them. But he's also talking about how, like, he's clearly it's pain. But I'm thinking to myself, if you wanted a warrior robot, what's the point of having it hurt?
Why does it have pain?
Like, it should be, you shoot the thing, this that should be like, saying, whatever kind of thing.
The first movie has holes everywhere.
I'm
surprised all these super cultist dweebs who watch it over and over and over, like my partner, have not spotted any of these holes.
Yeah, but that's just 1982 movie. Like nowadays, people kind of button this stuff down tighter. They don't let, a lot of things were let loose in the olden days. You didn't have like that continuity supervisor who sold jobs and make everything was perfect.
Fair enough.
You know, with the Vangelis, we haven't talked about the music. Vangelis, of course, well known for Chariots of Fire, right? Who did the music there?
See, Chariots of Fire did Blade Runner. I think he did one other, and that was pretty much his. He didn't have a big movie.
There's a couple articles talking about like, hey, nobody called up Vangelis for the new one. I guess he's still around.
But I think he collaborate.
But the interesting thing is on the new one, they actually changed the music person to get, like, they had one music person and their stuff was, I think it was I can't remember if they started with the guy person who did Sicario's music. You know, Sicario has that weird music.
Yes.
And so does Arrival to a lesser extent. But Sicario, like, really, like this, like, it's a new variation on what's his name stuff.
Sicario is now it's funny. We talk about that movie.
But they ultimately replaced the person who was doing the music on the new one for somebody who would do music more like Vangelis.
And to be fair,
I wouldn't have known. No, like, if you had told me about Vangelis,
I think the score of the second one, you know, and again, I think Vangelis' music to a point, I don't like that style of music really that much. Like, I do think it's sort of oddly incongruent with Chariots of Fire. But I do feel in Blade Runner, it's the music isn't about the music. It's just about atmosphere. And so by having someone not do a Vangelis knockoff, but do a Vangelis tribute, definitely help create that atmosphere.
Vangelis, not Vangelis.
Vangelis. I don't know.
There are a lot of names in this that you don't hear people say. So
I will say something. We keep mentioning Sicario, a film I liked a lot. But in a strange way, I find that. Quite similar. Thinking about it now, that's quite similar to Blade Runner, and it's really good looking. But actually, much ado about not a lot. Really,
I have a hard time rewatching that. Like I thought it was great in the movies. It's on TV, because you know what's going on, you're this is a lot of work.
It's sort of a one shot deal, and it's like
much more depressing when you already know where it's going to go.
So anyway, that's aside.
Other bits. So Edward James Olmos is one of the sidekicks. Not sidekick. He's sort of like another Blade Runner. But when they're interviewing him, at some point he's talking about androids and replicants, and he refers to them as Cylons.
And
of course, he was like the captain in the Battlestar Galactica
space career,
series. And so, like, he basically, I thought it was kind of funny. Like, Cylons. He's like, I mean the replicants. You like this is that they're talking to a bunch of directors on the movie. Like, this background thing was done, I think, in 2007 or before.
Yeah.
And so the mixture of people who are appearing on it is a little weird. Like, some of them, I don't even have any idea they are. But they have the director of Shawshank Redemption on. And he is adamant that, I don't care what anybody says, this guy's not a replicant. Like, he's a real person.
Did he work on the movie then?
No, they just had a lot of talking heads. Yeah. They had some woman who, like, runs some, she's got some tattoo. I think that was her entitlement.
Runs a sci-fi comic book store.
It was like a website or something. I've never heard of this website. It was like Rouge or something like that. I'm like, I never heard of this thing before. There's some extra scenes, like, you can watch it. Like, so one of the big things is at the end, the original ending they had there, they had them driving off.
Yeah.
Although I think they were in a space car.
They're in an air car. Apparently they used
aerial footage from The Shining.
Oh, really?
Like helicopter shots from that.
But it does seem sort of slightly soft focus and smoky and airy. So, and I'm always never sure if that's real.
But they have
when I watch the original version.
So when they did the director's cut, they actually cut it. Like, they don't show you any of that.
No.
Like, they don't want you to give you, hey, did they live happy forever?
No, it just happened
kind of thing. But in the one of the alternate scenes, they're driving down a road in a car. Like, it's a long extended shot of the two of them. And she turns to him and goes, are you and I lovers? It's like all this very rough dialogue. Like, you can see the car kind of rattling along. You can see why they never used that one. Something about his wife, because he had an ex-wife, played a much larger role before. Like, did you know your wife a long time is in there? And something about them, there's a line in that one that says, we were made for each other. Like, this is Sean Young is saying this. And so that quote unquote, which is almost a plot line of the new one, where there's a hint in the new one that they were engineered to meet each other.
But this does come back to my issue with the original Blade Runner, that I do sense that so many decisions were made. Yes, a lot of decisions were made because different people trying to get involved in the creative process. But I also think there was a notion of you can go too far creating ambivalence. And I think they over-sharpened the pencil. I'm not left with an ambivalent movie. I'm left with a movie that just not making a point.
It was a struggle.
That is my criticism of it. And that right there, you know, if you remove all the stuff like that, then you're not left with any clues at all. And if you're not left with any clues, then as a viewer, you're actually not sure what you're looking for something. Now, to be fair, I never find it. It's only now when I watch Blade Runner now that I am more aware of looking for, is the lead character what he thinks he is? But I'll be honest with you, if you just watch it for the first time or more casually, I'm not entirely convinced. At some moment, stories work because they do have to telegraph some things to the viewer.
Well, so I
don't think Blade Runner telegraphs enough to the viewer going, hey, this lead guy might not be who he says he is. Now, as long as you telegraph that first question, you can then be ambivalent the rest of the movie.
I'm blanking out on the director's name from Inception and the Batman thing.
No, Christopher Nolan.
Right, so the thing about, again, I think you got to give it a break because it was 1982. And in 1982, people wouldn't have done a movie with these hidden levels. Like, you know, they weren't going to rely on internet websites going over them. That movie was what the movie was. And so particularly the producers are going to say,
okay,
more direct, more simple.
Okay. But,
you know, like, it's like if you tried to Christopher Nolan planted him in 1982, people would be like, this Inception movie here, this is really confusing. So let's write out this whole idea that they're in dreams and, like, you know, like, they would have taken all this stuff out and it would have become a press pack.
Nowhere in the original press pack does it say Blade Runner tells the story of a detective.
No, I'm not.
Detective hunting down replicants.
My point is,
even he may not be as who he seems.
No. My point is, it was boiled out of it because of that. Like, the director may have wanted these things, and you got to give him credit for doing that. But somebody said, tamp it down, take that stuff out, and make it more marketable. A couple other bits. So, we mentioned before different candidates for roles. So most of them, like Rutger Hauer, was. He had a long meeting with them, Ridley Scott, and me, and cast.
He closed the deal right away.
This is sort of an interesting story. I mean, if you watch the background, Harrison Ford, of course, was, you know, selected because he was Harrison Ford. He didn't have to test for anything.
But he was third or fourth choice.
Two of them.
Well, no, maybe not. But he wasn't the only. I mean, no. We talked about Dustin Hoffman and Robert Mitchum, and there's a couple of other names.
The two, Rachel, who went me, Sean Young, and I forget the character, Pris,
who's Daryl Hannah.
Daryl Hannah. Both of those were differently, like, those had full casting open, and on the background materials has, like, the other people. And
oh, really?
They're not famous people. Like, okay. they were in a bunch of, like, horror movies after that or something like that. But the most interesting story I found out of that was for Pris, They had them do full-blown screen tests, but they said, you guys, as characters, dress up, make up, do it yourself. What do you think this character is? So they got the whole dialogue there. The white wig and the makeup that Daryl Hannah wears, she brought that to her own audition. She said, I'm going to put all this stuff on. And one of the other people who was auditioning was this really tiny woman who had a completely different look. Like, it looked like a totally different thing. And Daryl Hannah said she gets there and she's like some weird Amazon thing and she felt like a complete freak. But they were like, as they saw that, they're like, that is the character. Like, not this weird looking small woman with the little features and like curly hair and stuff. Like, this is this oddball sort of doll, Amazon doll.
It's like that line character from Seinfeld. Why don't you tell me the movie that you want to watch? It's like, we don't know. So you come in and dress up. Yeah.
And then the last thing I was going to tell a little story about was Dangerous Days, the original script. They're going over the storyboard and they start telling the story that the original scene was going to be that Decker character breaks into a house where believes there's an android, and he gets in there before the person's in there, sits on the couch, and there's a stove on the oven. And the guy was mentioned, Hampton Francher, is talking about like this scene with the stove on the oven, and we don't know what the stove is, the pot on the stove. Pot on the stove, yeah.
Pot on the stove.
So it's boiling away, and then the guy who's the android comes in there and just sort of knows that Decker's there, but doesn't really pay him. He goes over and starts dealing with the pop, blah, 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 all this stuff. And I'm like, it's the opening scene. It's the opening scene from the new movie. Yeah. And I'm like, that's pretty cool that they took something that was written before, thrown out, and they said, let's put it in here in a completely different purpose.
Let me tell you something. This happens all the time in Hollywood. I actually have a copy of a script for Timothy Dalton's third James Bond movie that never got made. And
It was on the internet and it all went around
and you could download it, and it is the working script, and it has been verified as the working script, and about a half of it was rejiggered and showed up as GoldenEye, the Pierce Brosnan movie, and there are all kinds of other scenes. And it was only later when I watched Skyfall that I suddenly realized that in this property of the James Bond film production company, in a script that was written in 1991, there's a whole thing where James Bond and the girl are in a house and it is attacked by a single helicopter and the house is in the middle of the country. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, ooh, yes, this is just an idea that the company have had. Bung it in the new.
Well, at least, for James Bond, at least they come in at like a parade. It happens 35 years later, somebody said, let's pull that story up from there.
In
fact, the fact that it was in the, obviously the documentary on this thing was done in 2007, well before this movie was even, you know, thought of, or I'm sure it's thought of, but before they get this movie. So I almost wonder if whoever put it into the new movie learned of it by watching the documentary, not pulling out an old script.
But it's the same writer.
I guess Hampton Francher.
So he probably said, this is a really great scene, and it is a great scene in the new movie.
Yeah.
So there you
go. That's Batista. He's the wrestler. He's making quite a career for himself.
Yeah, he's come out of wrestling. He's done James Bond. He's done Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah. And he's now in Blade Runner. And to be fair, he'll probably end up in a Fast and the Furious movie. He's quite a good actor. Yeah. And in a strange way, he's quite a good actor, despite the fact that he's probably stereotyped by being this big.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But he's very good. He's excellent in that scene at the start of the movie.
One of the in-between shorts that you can get on YouTube, by the way, if you really want to pursue all the geeky stuff.
Oh, yeah.
One of the shorts really revolves around him.
Yeah.
And it's like from a year before this happens.
All right. So basically, in conclusion, the original Blade Runner, rubbish. Blade Runner 2049. Yeah, it's worth a go if you like that sort of thing.
In conclusion, original Blade Runner,
It's a much better movie than I'll ever give it credit for.
Piece of art.
Oh, it's problematic.
That has its flaws due to an era when it was brought about.
All right.
But you can see through them, and it has a deeper meaning than the new one. New one, much better made, has good meanings to it as well. They tried to fit too much crap into it.
All right. I mean, now, as you watched all these and did all the research, I'm going to concede that as the show's conclusion. I'm not going to concede it as a legitimate position. I think I've made it clear.
We have to wrap up at some point.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Those of you who stuck around enjoyed the extra pieces.
Yeah, but it is interesting.
Most of these you can see if you want to borrow the disc from me.
Borrow the disc. Email us. We'll send you the disc.
And I haven't even gotten through the whole 2.5 hours
of the Dangerous Days documentary. If you email us and get Amazon key, we'll send it to you, delivery, and you can have it
done. Just let me know what the code is to get it.
All right. This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for the Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.